Okay. Your initial approach kind of evolved from the musical side of things, and then
absolutely
you, that grid on top of the harmonic overtones. Okay, so are you ready to talk about how you kind of discovered and started your journey into applying the use of harmonic overtone series to your mixing?
Yes. I was driving home from San Francisco. Hopefully my blood alcohol level was legal, but I'm not sure. And I was listening to a Sheryl Crow record with a Bob Clearmountain mix that I love. And I realized, wow, it's all in tune. And by all in tune, I don't mean, you know, that the guitarist tuned his instrument. I meant that the mix was in tune, that the overtones of, you know, it was really in the cymbals and the string orchestra, the violins. I noticed that everything was hanging together in a really interesting way, that it just, there's no other way to describe it in except to say that it was in tune. The mix, the sonics were in tune as opposed to the music. And I went home and fired up Pro Tools, and it kind of only took 2 seconds for me to realize what was going on, which was that the harmonics of the sounds themselves, the frequencies that were boosted and cut, were all in the same key. And so I started playing around with that. I found a harmonic overtones chart online, and I pulled up a mix that I was working on, and I don't remember what key the song was in, but that's a ba-dum-bum key element of harmonic mixing, is knowing the tonality, is picking a tonality, because obviously songs can change key or change tonal center in the middle of a piece of music, and you don't need to, like, all of a sudden, but you don't need to jump through hoops in order to address that in harmonic mixing. I'm getting ahead of myself, but let's say that harmonic mixing at its barest element is, let's say that you've got a song in the key of G. Let me pull up my harmonic mixing chart as we speak. So anyhow, if you've got a song in the key of G and you are doing your EQ wing as you mix the song, an oversimplification is that you're going to cut frequencies that are inharmonic, that are dissonant in the key of G, and you're going to boost frequencies that are consonant, that are harmonically pleasing in the key of G. You know, again, I'm not really equipped to talk about the overtone series, but I do know that the frequencies that are consonant are increasingly closer together as you go higher up the frequency spectrum, and they're further apart the lower that you are. It's hard to talk about this stuff without something making sound in front of you.
That's okay.
But like for example, the lowest G that we've got on the frequency chart is about 49 hertz. Mm-hmm. And so if I was working on the bass for this mix in the key of G, and, you know, I was trying to bring out the fundamental of the bass a little bit, I would boost 49 hertz. And if I was hearing some grunge in it, in the very, very low range, I might cut a little bit around 70 hertz, which is C sharp. And that's the flatted fifth or sharp fourth, arguably the most dissonant tone in the key of G.
Okay, so that's very interesting. You'd look at the key of G, and then you would choose a note in the key of G that is the potentially most sour note,
mm-hmm.
and you would pull that frequency out of the bass line.
Yeah, I mean, I'd pull just a little bit out of out of the bass sound. And it's not like, you know, it's not like I'm pulling the note out of the performance or anything like it. I'm just pulling that frequency out of the spectrum of the sound of the instrument. So it's a subtle effect, but what happens is, especially in the context of the entire mix, once you do this for all the instruments, always using your ear as the guide, I can't stress that enough, using your ear in conjunction with the frequency chart. Once you do that, everything starts to hang together. And, you know, one thing that you learn if you do this for everything is that we need a little dissonance. Mm-hmm. And you can totally castrate a mix just following the harmonic mixing concept. And you can also make it really harsh and buzzy too, because you know, there's only so many G's and so many D's, which is the fifth in the key of G, to go around, you know, and like a D right in the middle range is about 1.2K, you know, and that can be, you know, too much of that can be kind of annoying. And so, you know, you end up boosting some things like especially, you know, where in the meat of where a lot of the musical information happens, you know, between 200, you know, hertz and 1,000, you end up boosting the major third or even the fourth. But you also, you know, you cut the dissonant stuff, the flatted second, you know, one half step above the root note, the flatted fifth, again, the minor sixth. There's always stuff that you can pull out, and you have to be careful not to boost the same frequencies over and over again in a bunch of instruments. You need to kind of spread the love around. But using the pitch frequency chart as a guide, it is a relatively foolproof way to get a clean sounding mix going. And especially if you have no idea of what to do, if you're just starting out and you know things sound bad, but you don't know why and you don't know what those things are, this is great for that.
So one of the kind of fundamental prerequisite skills or bodies of knowledge that someone would need to apply this is at the very least to understand how to build a major scale or a minor scale as an additional reference of information.
Yeah. You do need to have it in front of you, you know, like if, you know, it helps to know what key your song is in, because you do need to pick a key.
You know the scales like the back of your hand,
sort of.
You don't need to reference, oh, a G major scale has an F sharp in it, and you already know what the one chord is and the four chord or whatever. But for any other student that doesn't really exactly know what a D major scale is, for example, they should have some kind of reference or some kind of training in that area. That would be helpful.
Yeah, the goddamn internet has all that stuff.
Yeah. Cool. So just continuing the hypothetical understanding of our song in the key of G,
mm-hmm.
We have the low end kick drum and we have the low end bass guitar.
Yeah.
And if you choose to have the bass synth or the bass guitar be the lowest fundamental pitch of the song as opposed to the kick drum, right?
Yeah, you put the bass below the kick, yeah.
So yeah, unless it's like Dale Everingham last night. There was a song called 808, you know, and there wasn't even a bass in the song, actually.
Right,
But sometimes the kick will be chosen to go underneath. But in this case, if we choose, we put the bass underneath. So if you're going to be boosting that bass, you might choose first to boost the fundamental frequency of, in essence, 49 hertz, right? And then for the kick drum, if you wanted to boost the kick, you might go to the G1, which would be 98 hertz.
Which is very convenient because there's usually some energy there around 100 hertz, yeah.
Yeah, very convenient. And then for cutting on the kick drum, right, you kind of know where those convenient areas of cutting might be. We know that between 200 and 400, a lot of times those frequencies sound kind of boxy.
Yeah.
But how would you go about addressing what frequencies to cut on that 98 hertz kick drum fundamental tone?
Well, I usually go for 400 first, and so G sharp, a very dissonant note in the key of G, is at 415, so I would go there first.
G sharp 3.
Yeah.
Battleship, it's a winner. Okay, right. So now you chose 400 hertz based on your experience.
Correct.
That 400 hertz tends to sound kind of boxy. It's a bad, evil frequency that makes kick drums sound bad.
Yeah.
Right? And because you know it's in that area, you used your frequency chart to kind of fine-tune and hone in on a specific frequency to cut.
Exactly
that,
right.
That fits your grid, fits your matrix and overall design.
That's correct.
Actually, G sharp, F sharp, all of those could arguably be bad frequencies, anything other than 391 or 392.
Right. Yeah. Right? So you would just use your ear, you know, and certainly if there's other instruments where you wanted to clear some things up, you would want to try to pick a different frequency. I'm not sure anyone uses frequency charts, you know, the mixers that we listen to, that in-tune Bob Clearmountain mix that I heard.
Yeah.
I doubt very strongly that he has a pitch frequency chart in front of him, but he kind of has one in his head.
Yeah.
And so that kind of stuff just happens naturally. This is the harmonic mixing concept is a really great way to start to train your ear to hear how to mix things.
What was the name of that song and album by Sheryl Crow?
Oh, the album's Wildflowers. And Andy Wallace does some mixes on that record too, but I'm thinking it's a dun 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 dun. I'm gonna just go to Amazon right now to see the. Is Letter to God, I think, is the name of the song. It's really impressive mix. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, it's Letter to God. Wildflowers is a really great record.
Yeah, so the idea is that when you're choosing frequencies to boost and cut, you're not so much thinking of the harmonic overtone series ratios to the fundamental. You're thinking of the musical interval relationships to the fundamental.
Yes, I am. That's correct.
Sometimes you may think, well, just by the law of the octave, you're able to keep in the key of G. And I suppose knowing that it's a coincidence that the fifth and the third are part of the harmonic overtone series, so you're going to hit them either way.
Right.
What about rhythm guitar? And I know we don't have a song, so we're just talking hypothetically here, but this is actually a very interesting way to kind of jump into the concept. We're looking at this chart. We don't really have a song, but hypothetically, here's an acoustic guitar. We're just still in the key of G. What might you do with the acoustic guitar?
Well, it depends. Depends on a great many things, but an acoustic guitar, you'd probably want to do a little roll off, although, you probably want to do some high pass filtering, because when you do a high pass filter, the point where the filter cuts off, there's usually a little boost there, so you definitely want to make that happen at the fundamental or the fifth, so I might do a little roll off. Very little, like 60 dB per octave, maybe at D2 at 146.
All right, so the logic there is, assuming it's a well-recorded mono acoustic guitar.
Which is a serious assumption.
beautiful Martin acoustic guitar with a C12 tube microphone, perfectly placed by Jeff Saltzman, right? It sounds great.
Sounds great,
and,
man.
You're working on a song. It's a rather rich orchestration, and you know that this guitar is going to be part of the bigger picture. It's not a solo guitar. And
right. And
so something that you know works in general is to roll off some of the low end so the guitar won't be conflicting and competing with the lower frequencies like the bass that we already addressed.
Correct.
So what you're saying is to choose that frequency on where you're cutting, to be conscious and mindful of the key of the song, which is G. The question might be, do I cut at 97.9, or do I go up in the key of G to the third or the fifth? And you're recommending that maybe we go D2. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And now the important thing is that even though this is a cut, because it's a filter rather than a notch, we are actually cutting on an enharmonic note rather than an inharmonic one. We're cutting on a consonant note rather than a dissonant one. Mm-hmm. While I'm talking about when we're pulling out grunge or something, we're going for the dissonant notes in our hypothetical key of G. But because this is a filter, and you're going to get a slight boost at the place where you cut. We don't want to boost a dissonant frequency, so we're putting this filter centered around a harmonic note.
You're talking about the inherent characteristic of high pass filters to boost the amplitude of the cutoff frequency.
Correct.
And different types of filters have different inherent characters, and that's why Neve sounds different than API. And
correct.
A lot of the plugins allow us to actually control that slope, don't they?
Correct. Yes, absolutely.
So you might actually, after you apply this high-pass filter at 146 hertz, you might decide to tweak the amount of boost or bump at that cutoff frequency.
Indeed.
Okay, so that takes care of cutting the sludge out of the acoustic guitar, and it also has it has that little inherent value-added bonus of boosting at a harmonic frequency of the song. And then what else might you do on the acoustic guitar?
Oh, you know, again, I might be looking in the 200s, depending. There might be something getting in the way of the vocal around 250, you know, because a lot of the warmth of the vocals around 250, you know, so it all depends. Might pull a little something around there.
So your process in determining what frequencies to cut in the acoustic guitar start from you listening to the acoustic guitar. And it sounds to me like you've developed an innate awareness of what the different frequencies sound like even before you start mixing. So you can hear 200 hertz in the guitar. Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How did you develop that very important skill?
Well, I read this article. I read this interview with, I think it was with Captain Beefheart back when he did interviews. And he was talking about being in the studio with Frank Zappa, you know, when they were both teenagers. And Zappa, you know, he talked enviously about Zappa saying, you know, we need to pull out that 400, you know, in the whatever. And I'm like, oh, that'd be interesting to be able to hear that stuff. And so it's kind of been a thing. I do have to tell you, it's been a long time coming, and there are people who are way better at that stuff than I am. It's like sight reading. Yeah, I'm really good at that. Hearing frequencies and stuff like that. I'm a producer. I'm a piano player. I'm not an awesome hear frequency guy, but I do know the difference between 200 and 400.
Have you spent some time with an equalizer, parametric equalizer, or a shelving peak type equalizer, and boosting the amplitude and then sweeping the frequency knobs through the sound to listen to what different frequencies sound like when you boost them?
If I was not married, I would not get regularly laid. Is that an answer to your question? Yes. Yes is the answer. Yes. Yeah, I have spent. Yeah.
And so by familiarizing yourself with what these basic kind of the general frequencies, like you have an idea of what it sounds like when you boost 100 hertz on a guitar, mm-hmm. and what it sounds like when you boost 500 hertz on a guitar.
Oh, don't do that.
When you hear a guitar straight up with no EQ, just totally flat, you can instantly kind of assess and perceive the frequencies in that sound, so you can kind of anticipate where the bulk of the frequencies are living in a given track.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think that's an important part of the basic ear training skills that any mixer needs to get a handle on, is a basic awareness of, you know, what does 200 hertz sound like, what does 1 kilohertz sound like, and what does 5K sound like. Right.
It is very helpful. I mean, you can always, you know, and it's not to say that sometimes I just don't twirl knobs until it sounds right.
Right, yeah.
But yes, it does. The more that you can have of that stuff, it's just another tool, you know. It can lead you down the garden path. You can find yourself cutting and boosting stuff without really listening. And yeah. I think everybody who does a lot of this has been guilty of that, just going for what they know works. And one interesting aspect of making music is that even day to day, same signal path, same instrument, same performer, same mic, it's going to sound a little different. It's just the way it works. Don't know why, but it does.
For me, the interesting thing is kind of bridging and connecting the bigger picture of your musical experience and your intuitive experience and doing what sounds good and having a general area, and then using the harmonic mixing techniques to kind of fine-tune and refine those initial intuitive decisions.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, it's just another thing to add to the arsenal. And like I said, harmonic mixing is a great way to get started because, you know, you're sitting there and you're like, wow, what do I cut? What do I boost? Here's a great way to kind of get your feet wet with that stuff. But it does ultimately become another tool, just like any of this stuff does, because your intuition wins. If it sounds good, trust me, it is good. You know, you need go no further than that. But to have these different tools at your disposal, whether it's knowledge of, you know, start around 400 to cut from a kick or whatever, or yeah, the harmonic mixing chart in a more specialized sense, it's just another tool to help make great sounding stuff.
One of the workflows for something like this might be take your equalizer and crank up the gain, the old school, crank up the gain and then sweep with the frequency selector and try to shine light on the worst sound to try to accentuate and amplify the bad part of the sound, for instance, the mud of the acoustic guitar. Now that we found it, we can cut that. And then you might consult your frequency chart to try to refine that frequency to something that fits in your grid.
Yeah. In general, yes, and certainly a lot of people work that way. Here's the problem. Your ear can very easily get confused, and once you start sweeping, you don't know what you're hearing anymore. So the better way to do this, and this is hard, I have gotten better at doing this. The thing to do is you're not listening. You're not boosting. What you're saying is, and this is for cutting or boosting, but especially for cutting, you're listening to the sound, and what you say is, I'm going to cut to 41.5. And so you set it, and then you do your cut of a couple dB, and you listen. Is it better? And that's the way that you're going to get more accurate. I know it sounds harder. It's easier to sweep, but your ear gets confused when you boost and sweep, especially if your intent is boosting to find the frequency you're going to pull out, because your ear lags, and your brain lags. And so if you think that you heard the frequency to cut, you're actually a little off. So it's better to cut first and then assess whether you were right or not, rather than to boost and sweep.
The workflow is still similar in that you start with your intuitive assessment of the frequency. You can cut it. You're saying that you prefer not to boost because it skews the ear and you don't want to like mess with what's going on. So you just cut initially and don't boost, and then try to make it fit. And then you look at your chart and say, well, you know, I might be able to move it up a few hertz or whatever to stay in that grid.
Yeah. If I'm having trouble or, if I'm just not getting the thing that I heard, I mean, usually the biggest thing that I find, this goes beyond the frequency chart, but I often find that if something's sounding weird and I'm cutting where I think the problem is and that isn't where the problem is, it's usually something really low. It's something below 100 hertz. That can really confuse you, especially if your room isn't perfect and no one's is. Uh-huh. So look below 100 hertz. That's the place to start. And the frequency chart's great for that. You know, if you go for an inharmonic, for a dissonant tone, below around 100, you very, very likely may get it. You'll be able to pretty quickly find the frequency that's giving you trouble. In the really low end and the really high end, like when you're trying to get cymbals and acoustic guitars to work together, and you're messing around with the high stuff, anything above 7 or 8, the frequency chart's great for that stuff, you know, because you can, the higher up, the harmonic frequencies are closer together, so you can boost the second, you know, the note a whole step above the tonic, or the third, you know, you can boost the second in the cymbals and the third in the acoustic guitars, or boost the third in the acoustic guitars and the fifth in the cymbals. And that's when you start to get that thing that I heard with that Bob Clearmountain mix initially, where the stuff was in tune.
Continuing with our imaginary acoustic guitar analogy in the key of G, we just
I'm
got
really
done
digging this part. Yeah,
we just got done cutting the 400 ish area, and now we're talking about some frequencies that we might boost to add a little bit of tingle and color. The high end gloss air that you were just talking about.
Yeah.
How might you approach that? What type of EQ settings might you use?
Well, in the key of G, you know, it kind of gets hard to hear what to cut specifically the higher up you get. I mean, in general, you want to 3K is kind of famous. One of the first things that you learn if you're studying anything about mixing is that 3K is going to bring something closer. It's going to bring it to the forefront, you know, and a little 3K goes a long way. But it's very definitely useful. If something is sounding far away, some of that's going to do it. So if I really want it to sound like the acoustic guitar is playing in the speakers, ooh, look there, 3135.964 is G6. So I would definitely be getting into some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
5K can add harshness if there's too much of it, but it can actually, it can help define your sound a little bit, and it'll back up. You know, I find sometimes I might add, you know, 4 dB of 3K and then 2 dB of 5K or something. And so D7 is at 4698, and so that might be useful to boost a little there at D7. And if I, to get some shimmering, I might use shelving EQ with a, you know, maybe 6 dB boost or 12 dB boost per octave at D8, which is 93, 97. Mm. So up towards 10K, where things really start to glisten.
You chose the fifth, and using a shelving type shape EQ for the very, very highest frequency.
Yeah.
Cool. That's really good. That really makes sense.
Yeah, the kind of the higher I get, the less likely I am to boost parametrically. I'm usually going to be doing a shelving thing above 8 or so, unless there's a very specific problem.
If for some reason the D did not work, what might you do?
The higher you get up in the frequency chart, the more that you can use rather than, you know, fifths or octaves, you can get into the third and stuff, or even the sixth can be nice. So I might, you know, use B7, which is the major third, and that's at 7902 at 8K.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If it didn't get too harsh, that might be nice. That would be around the lowest where I would use shelving EQ.
You talked about your technique of mixing and adjusting the EQ. You don't boost and sweep the frequencies in real time very often. Is that true?
Yeah, I try not to.
For making the decision between B7 and D8, You do it not in real time. You would make the change and then play, as opposed to play in real time and sweep the frequencies going down from 8 kilohertz down to, or, you know, 8372 down to 7902. As you're flying the ship, are you doing it in real time, making the changes, or do you hit stop, make the change, and then hit play?
Realistically, it would probably be playing. But the thing is that I'm moving from one frequency to another. And so while I'm doing it, I'm trying to not have my ears focus on it.
Uh-huh.
But realistically, I'm not going to stop the playback, because that can be jarring to the ear too.
Yeah, I'm just trying to clarify the workflow of your decision-making process, because as you know, and as you've said, this is not a cookie cutter system where you just line everything up, connect the dots, hit play, and it sounds good.
You're
using all of your vast knowledge and experience and your intuition and your art. The big decision is what frequency to choose. So you choose a frequency, and then as you're manipulating that frequency, you're changing the frequency parameter in real time while the music is happening. But you're saying that you're not really focusing on the sound of the EQ sweeping. So you're really
Correct.
Listening from point A to my destination, which is point B. You're not listening with intense concentration of all the different flavors of the different frequencies between 8372 and 7902.
I'm not. Especially in the high frequencies, you can get super confused where they all sound good or they all sound bad. So much of EQing, especially fine EQing, is a cumulative effect. And that's where the pitch frequency chart and harmonic mixing can be really useful, because it's you just don't hear it in each one thing that you do, but there is a cumulative effect where things start to settle in, and they all start to sound in tune.
Okay, that's a very good point. As you're making these EQ decisions, you're right. By itself, the acoustic guitar could sound very good at any. You boost a high shelving Martin guitar, it's going to sound great at any of these frequencies.
Whatever. And yeah, exactly.
You're saying just kind of default, if I have to choose one of these, they all sound great, I'm going to use this frequency chart to try to stay within this little list, because in the bigger picture, when I start adding everything else, the Fender Rhodes and the ukulele or whatever, it all starts coming together cumulatively, right?
Right. Exactly. That's exactly right. Yes. Yes.
As you discovered this and started working with it yourself, what were some of your observations, reflections, epiphanies? Did you go back and remix things, or did you start applying things? How did it progress and unfold?
It progressed very, very quickly from, my God, this is going to change everything, to, wow, I don't really need this that much. Because I was going through an extreme personal growth period where mixing and record making was concerned, where I was just disappointed that my mixes didn't sound the way I wanted them to. And I harmonic mixing enabled me to move very quickly in a very short time, but my ear was just ready to learn. And I very quickly started being able to make intuitive decisions as to what to boost and cut beyond the frequency chart. You know, my ears, I mean, they're never going to be where Bob Clearmountain's ears are, but they started to get closer to that, where I very quickly started to hear these little dissonances and areas of harmonic convergence, if you will. And when I went back and checked what I had done, this is stuff done without the frequency chart, they were very close to the spots on the frequency chart that would have been correct for a given song.
The majority of your years has been as a musician and then a composer and a producer. You're a performing artist, and you're the guy that chooses the notes from wherever those notes come from. You channel them down and you decide, you know, where the kick drums go. You make the patterns and you do all this music stuff. So you started out as a musician, as a composer,
right.
And then you started recording stuff and you started actually acquiring content through microphones and hitting the red button and recording stuff yourself, first onto tape machines and then onto digital audio workstations. And you would work on the bigger picture of content acquisition, but when it came to mixing, you were the first to defer this to a, quote, mixer, a bona fide professional mixer, because you didn't feel qualified for it, or you wanted your mixes to be the best possible, so you kind of deferred that to a specialist, which is a career in and of itself.
Absolutely.
And then you started doing mixes partially out of necessity, because your clients either could not afford to pay mixers, they didn't have the budget, or they didn't have the time, they wanted to do it right away. So you started doing mixing in projects that you perceived were not absolutely mission critical, or just on a practical level, they didn't have the bucks, right?
Or it was one thing that gave me a great amount of confidence. I remember working on a record that Jeff Saltzman engineered, and it was a jazz record. So it wasn't quite set it and forget it, but you know, it was recorded all in a space of 2 or 3 days, the basic tracks were. And there weren't a lot of tracks, and it was pretty simple, just some levels, a little EQ. And I remember there were a couple of tracks that he didn't have time to mix, so I just used his template. I just opened up some of his settings for EQ and compression from one song and applied them to another, and it ended up sounding really good, and I was able to look at kind of what he did in this particular mix, and then I thought it sounded good. He heard it and thought it sounded good. Client thought it sounded good. Sold a bunch of copies on CD Baby. So I'm like, oh, okay, you know, because so much of this is confidence. So much of all of this is just knowing that what you think sounds good actually does.
Yeah.
So that enabled me to keep moving from there. And then gradually, you know, it got to be like, oh, you know, this demo for this country song, yeah, I should be able to mix that, you know. And the more you do it, you know, the more you put a compressor on a snare drum, the more when you hear a recording of a compressor on a snare drum, you can say things like, oh, that snare drum's overcompressed, or, oh, that's really interesting. I'll bet that they're compressing the attack from of that snare drum separately than they're compressing the release, et cetera, et cetera. You know, your ear starts to reverse engineer things, and that gives you information and confidence to do it on your own. And it's, you know, it's a chain of pain.
So now you're at a point where your mixes and the quality of your work is right up there in, quote, world class. You're a world class mixer. Your mixes are competing, in my opinion, your mixes compete with some of the best mixers on the face of the planet. And we could look at some of your recent projects where your mixes are sitting right next to some of my favorite mixers in the world. Do you have any other tips or advice on what has helped bridge the gap?
Well, I mean, the most important thing is, because, you know, while I certainly have to have a certain amount of bluster and outside ego, you know, outwardly apparent ego, and there are certainly things that I feel that I'm really good at, you know, I'm never going to rest, especially where engineering and mixing are concerned, partially because I came to it relatively late compared to the other things in my skill set. To a certain extent, that gives me an additional amount of fascination with it. And there's so much to learn, especially because of the technology. I'm running around my major point, which is never rest. No matter how good you are or how good you think you are, you know, even if you're making a great living at it and things sound good to you, you can always be better. And, you know, if you keep learning, you never die, really, or you die a very long time from now, feeling pretty good up till the last possible minute, you know. So it's a good thing to keep learning.
What are some of the ways that contribute to your ongoing mix education?
Listening.
How do you do that?
Well, you know, I buy music. Don't steal music, kids, except to check something out to see whether you want to buy it. You know, I just am always listening to new things, seeking them out, you know, indie stuff through Pitchfork, you know, pop music through, you know, watching Gossip Girl or whatever. I'm actually not kidding.
What's your current listening playback system for consuming music personally?
Like most professional music makers, I have a crap system for listening day to day. I listen to a lot of music in my car. Usually, I have an Infinity with a decent sound system, I listen to things on my iPod. I try, if I've bought a CD, I try to burn it full bandwidth onto the pod, and listen to that.
Ed, please explain full bandwidth.
Oh, just not MP3s, mm-hmm. 44.1, 16-bit, the full mix. MP3s sound awful good. Apple lossless sounds great. That's an option in your iTunes. You can burn a CD in with some amount of data compression, so it's a little smaller. But their lossless algorithm, to my ears, really is in that all the audio is there. Although it's a larger file than an MP3. The Apple MP4, the default format that you buy music on iTunes, sounds pretty good. 256K MP3s sound pretty good to my ear right now. So anyhow, I listen to a lot of music. I still read magazines, although I do find, I hope it's not hubris, I hope it's not arrogance, there is less to be learned for me now from most of the stuff in the magazines, especially with the economy. People are really trying to sell gear and stuff. But I still read and always will. Certainly if one of my heroes, like Bob Clearmountain or one of the Lord Alges, the Lord Alges aren't my heroes, but I am interested in how they mix. Any of those guys from Virginia Beach, who are doing the hip hop and the pop stuff, I'm always interested to see what they say. If you want to start reading a magazine, Sound on Sound, the British magazine, is kind of my favorite.
It's a great one. I subscribe to that too. Yeah.
And if you don't like pop music and are more interested in taking a shotgun mic and recording a bunch of broken bottles of various sizes and using that to make your baseline, Tape Op magazine is really good, and it's free.
Yeah.
That's kind of it. Don't get too hung up on gear, but make sure that you've got a decent signal path. And keep doing it. Make sure that you finish things. Make sure that you finish things. That's a really important thing.
So you learned by opening up the Jeff Saltzman jazz mix, you were able to take a peek at some of his plugin configurations and use that as a template. So that helped you learn how to mix.
Absolutely. Although, and this is sort of a standing thing, you'll find this a lot when the really good guys, there's nothing special going on. Beyond some certain obvious tricks, especially about modern drum sounds, there are some tricks. But a lot of it with EQ and compression, you talk to the really great mixers, the stuff that sounds really good, and it's going to blow you away how little they're doing.
One final question. In your personal workflow, what do you have to say about mixing 100% in the box and integrating outboard processors in your final mix?
For me, I really need Total Recall. The way that I work, I could literally spend a little time with 6 or 8 different songs in the course of a day, just doing little tweaks and stuff. So I need to mix 100% in the box. However, I've become increasingly concerned isn't the right word, but I've become increasingly focused at getting the best possible sounds on disc. I'm a relatively recent evangelist of making sure that you've got a great signal path going in, and making sure that the sound that you've got on disc without any plugs is close as possible to the sound that you want for the final mix, and that's talking about using EQ and compression, or whatever you need. Maybe not spatial processing, not reverb and delay, except as a special effect, but trying to get your raw sound to be as good as possible on disc. It'll make it easier for you to put your song, for you to put your arrangement together, because you're going to have compelling sounds coming up off of the disc for you. And it's going to make mixing easier too, because you need to mess with the sound less. You know, because any EQ or compressor that you put in, especially in the box, as good as these are, I mean, you are distorting the sound in the original sense of the word. I mean, you are changing it in some way, and there is going to be loss. There's going to be degradation, and just like harmonic mixing, it's a cumulative effect. You instantiate a little EQ on a hi-hat. What can be the harm in that? Well, nothing, you know. But with any kind of processing, it's a cost-benefit analysis. Is the act of instantiating a plug, the deleterious effects that you get from that, are they overwhelmed by the positive effect that you're going to get by what this EQ or compression is going to bring to the party? But there's no question, or there's very little question, that making the sound right in the tracking process is the best way to do it. The best way to come up with a good mix and an easy mix is to make it sound right when it's going in.
So in order to maintain total recall, if you're working with a project that was not necessarily tracked in the most exquisite, perfect standards,
like every project,
you might do some kind of preparatory processing and then recommit those as new audio files on your hard drive to maintain total recall. Is that right?
Absolutely. I do that all the time. I have an API lunchbox, and I have, I need preamps. I don't usually run stuff through extra preamps, but I will like reamp stuff. I'll take guitar stuff that was done with the intent of having a virtual amp. And, you know, whenever somebody's tracking guitar for me, I'll say, okay, do whatever you want, but give me a clean preamp sound too, so that I can mess with it. Because people always distort guitars too much in general.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I use my lunchbox a lot with different compressors and EQs that I've got, and I will run raw tracks through those, especially vocals.
So that's the best of both worlds. You're using your outboard API EQ and your high-end analog compression. You'll process stuff, and then you print it back into Pro Tools, and then when you do your mix, you can continue 100% in the box.
That's right. Chad Blake, 100% in the box. Mike Shipley, 100%.
What are some of your favorite plugins that are must-have for your best work today?
I use the McDSP filter bank and compressor bank as my go-tos, and it's feasible that there are some better things right now, but I know how to use them so well that I... those are what I go to. I mean, I know people like the Sony Oxford EQs, and I like those okay too. And I'm not a Waves guy, with one significant exception, which I'll get to in a second. But I know that, the Waves EQs, both the Renaissance and even just the basic, Q10 or whatever it's called, those are really, really powerful. But I do use the McDSP. They're great for really zeroing in on something, and I really like the way the shelving sounds and stuff like that. But beyond that, I've got these API 550Bs that I use for tracking, and man, do those sound sweet. The 10K shelving, so good.
Have you tried any of the API EQ plugins?
The API EQ plugin from Waves sounds exactly like the hardware 550B. It is a fantastic plug.
But you haven't acquired it yet.
I haven't, because I have a child who's going to need to go to college. I did get the Waves SSL bundle because of the bus compressor, and love it. Yeah, I love it. I love it. Don't hit it too hard. Don't hit it too hard when you're mixing on the master bus. You can hit it hard, like on a vocal. You can have it squash an 8 dB or whatever, and it'll work on the master bus. Don't let it go above 4 or so. But it's great. It's great. It's great at 2-1. It sounds great.
I remember when Steve Jarvis came to my studio back in the 90s and let me try out the SSL stereo compressor. And once I put that on the stereo bus, that compressor never left my studio for years. And I rented it from him on a month-to-month basis. Right. And when I started mixing in the box, the very last piece of gear that I removed from my Pro Tools rig was, in fact, the SSL compressor, because I couldn't imagine how you could possibly mix without it. And I've tried the SSL Waves version, and it sounds reminiscent in the ballpark, but I've never put it right next to the real thing and heard it in real time. But when you set up your stereo bus compression and your stereo processing, where do you do that in the workflow of your mix? Do you do it pretty early on and do your automation rides into it?
Yeah, I do. Increasingly, as I get comfortable, more comfortable mixing, I do have the SSL on right from the beginning. I mean, I'll get rough levels together.
Yeah.
One thing that I'm really trying to do more nowadays, because it's the way all the guys do it, all the pro guys, is have everything up at the beginning, and then you just cut away anything that doesn't sound like a mix. And what I mean by that is you don't solo. You really try not to solo, because what the fuck? You know, you're not going to be soloing the hi-hat in the course of the record, so it really doesn't matter what it sounds like on its own. I know that's a hard one to get around, but anything you can't hear, right? So it takes a while to get used to that. So, and everybody solos on occasion, but you shouldn't. However, I'm trying not to, okay, let's get the rhythm section together, and then let's bring in the vocal.
You know?
I'm trying to bring everything up at once, get rough levels, and then I'm really trying to do things through rides. Even, you know, I don't like micro rides. I like to compress a vocal. I think things sound better that way rather than...
I'm sorry. Can you please define rides?
Automating levels of tracks.
How do you enter that data?
I do it with the mouse. Uh-huh. I do not do it in real time.
You use the different tools, the grabber tool and the pencil tool.
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say that I won't change, but I'm a mouse mixer. I don't have a fader box, although I just bought a Nord Stage, and supposedly there's some, which I love, but supposedly there's some cool things that you can do to control a bunch of faders at once via the stage. So I might experiment with that. But, you know, I am comfortable with the way I work, and I don't like adding a lot of new things. It's really easy to get caught up in the latest piece of equipment.
Yeah, you can waste so much time. And you don't want to beta test the latest plugin on a project you're mixing for a client, you know?
No. So that's really important. But one more thing about the plugs that I like and stuff. I like Reverb One, although the new Air plugs, the new RTAS plugs for PT8, which will work in PT7 point whatever, don't forget that. Those sound real good, some of the reverbs and stuff like that. So, and I love the, it used to be Oxford, now I guess it's Sonox, the inflator. The inflator goes on the master bus for me when I'm 3/4 done with the mix and it stops sounding good. Uh-huh. And so then I throw on the inflator and I'm like, oh, it sounds good again. Because the inflator just does this mumbo jumbo, little compression, little enhancing, little whatever, just makes it sound better.
It's magic. Do you ever use the inflator on individual tracks like vocals or guitar or kick drum or snare?
Yeah, a little of it goes a long way. So a sound needs some help, because things can just get too bright and too artificial sounding if you use too much of the inflator. But I do like it. Another thing that I like, and I know there are other plugs that people speak of a little more highly as far as tape head and analog saturation emulators go, but I really like the McDSP analog channel, and I'll use that a lot. Again, it's a cumulative effect. And if I've got weak-ass drums that were just, like, recorded with 57s in some guy's untreated room or whatever, and maybe there's not a lot of boxy room sound, but the sounds just aren't compelling, a little bit of analog channel on each one helps to bring it together. More than putting it on a drum sub bus, I would put it on each individual instrument, and it does help things just get thicker and a little punchier and stuff.
So for your stereo bus, you'll have inflator and then into the SSL compressor. Do you still use a Massey limiter at the very end?
Yeah, what I do, because you don't want to hit any of these guys too hard, is usually my The way it works is I'll have an EQ first on the master bus, which only goes on at the very end. I don't mix with like 12K shelving up or anything like that. I don't do that. I have the EQ there for the last, that's first. And then comes the SSL compressor, and that will be on at the beginning, more or less at the beginning. And then I've got the Massey limiter, and it's just set for 2 or 3 dB, and I kind of throw that on about 3/4 of the way through the mix. And then final in the chain is the Oxford inflator. I'm talking bottom to top. The inflator needs to be the last thing in the chain because you can be you can be hitting the Massey limiter hard so it sounds great, and then, you know, you'll be getting your levels nice and hot throughout, and if you throw on the inflator after that, you can get up to 3 more dB of clean gain.
Oh, that's very interesting. I've never used the inflator as the last stage of the signal path, but that kind of makes sense. It's almost kind of the magic mojo tape emulation,
right?
Whatever it does, and you're feeding it this perfectly limited EQ, beautiful thing. And I suppose you could mix and match and drag change the order all day long and get wonderful results also.
I have done it. Also, it's best with the inflator last. Yeah.
The inflator, you can overdo the inflator.
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
But you're protected from doing that. I mean, I'll pull the Massey down a dB and a half once I throw the inflator in because I'm like, wow, too much. But even so, if I compare it before the inflator with full Massey or after the inflator with Massey down a dB and a half, there's no question that it's louder and better sounding with the inflator on it.
What kind of modifications would you make in the settings if you're sending this to a mastering engineer out of house?
It depends on the mastering engineer, but you know, if it's somebody that I really trust and things like that, I will back off on this stuff fairly substantially. But the most important thing that I'll do is I'll pull down the output of the inflator. I want to give my mastering engineer room to work with. So
some dynamics.
Yeah, I might pull. I wouldn't want to give him anything that peaks above -3.
Right. And also, you're keeping some dynamic range, so it's not just a brick line at -3.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. But other than that, I like the sound toys, too, for dicking around, for fun stuff. The Crystallizer, Echo Boy, love them.
I think when you have time to explore the new plugins, Pro Tools 8 Air plugins, there's a lot of Sound Toys-ish type of...
They're great.
Really cool. Such a wonderful selection of stuff.
Frequency shifter, love it.
How much internal submixing do you do as far as using auxiliary tracks to submix batches of like-minded sounds?
Tons.
In order to control and process them, and how much do you try to avoid that?
I do it a lot. I like to submix drums. I like to submix guitars. Sometimes I will submix mid-range. I'll have a bus send. Daddy's being indicted by a Senate committee subgroup, honey. Sometimes I'll have a send and I'll just. An aux send, obviously, with delay compensation on, and you know, I'll send it some guitars and stuff, and then there'll be an EQ with a mid-range boost and a very extreme compressor or a brick wall limiter, and I'll just bring that that aux send up in the mix just a little bit to just glue things together, just to give it some punch. And then with I'll do the same thing with drums. This is the famous New York trick from the 70s where you bust some kick,
parallel processing,
bust some kick, snare, and toms into an extremely, you know, limited SSL at 10:1 kind of thing, with the high end, with the low end rolled off, just to make the drums punchier. And another thing that I've been doing increasingly is split a snare out into two or three tracks and approach each aspect of the snare sound individually, where I'll process the attack and the body of it and the release with totally separate EQ and compression settings. And that's how guys get that modern snare sound off of almost any snare sound.
That's the parallel processing aspect of using aux tracks,
yeah,
or molting tracks. Maybe you just duplicate the tracks straight up.
Mm-hmm.
How about the submixing aspect? Using submixing so that all of the sound goes through the aux, it's like background vocals or whatever.
Exactly.
Do you do that very often?
Absolutely. Background vocals, acoustic guitars, like instruments. I triple track my backup vocals. So, you know, if there's like a three-part, you know, if three notes are forming the background vocal, there'll be nine tracks. There'll be three singers on each note. And so I might have those three voices for each track. They'll each have their own aux, three down to two, where I might do a little EQ and compression. And then I might take those three stereo auxes for the high, middle, and low parts and send those to an additional aux where I process the three background vocals as a whole, because I'll probably be manipulating individual levels of those three parts, those three stereo sub auxes in the course of the song to make the third come up on one particular line or whatever. But I'll also want to smooth out and possibly do high end on all of the vocals at the same time. In general, if you've got a different, you know, if it's not just a unison vocal line, I find that you do end up wanting to EQ and compress those vocals individually rather than just bussing all nine vocal tracks to a stereo aux.
My very final last question, I promise. How do you make your mixes sound good in your bedroom?
You know, I was just talking to a friend about this. It's knowing what things sound good in your bedroom. It's listening to a lot of music in your bedroom.
Are you happy with the way your bedroom sounds with your Genelec speakers?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool.
And they're pretty near field. I mean, even though I don't have any obvious, sound treatment in the room, I do, I have carefully made it so that there aren't any real standing waves around, just by placing things asymmetrically around the room and making sure that directly behind me, I've got some curtains and I've just got a bunch of garbage stuffed animals and stuff that break things up.
I think you have a large bookcase as well, right?
I do.
And that's a wonderful bass trap.
That's exactly right. Yeah, I have a big rack of modular synths on one wall and I have a bookcase on the other.
And what type of speaker arrays do you use to switch to get the speaker average?
I just have the Genelecs. I don't use
You have no other speakers? You don't listen to any little boombox or Oratones or anything?
Nah, because I have gotten to the point where I know what the Genelecs sound like. And I push my chair back a couple of feet to make sure that the bass is right. And that's it. That's it. And I'll listen in the car. Yeah, and I listen on my iPhone. I listen through the speaker in my iPhone.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's an acid test for your mixes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I can dig it.
Yeah.
That little tip alone is worth $100. This has been a great amount of preparatory information. Oh my God.
Cool, man.
Fantastic. I'll talk to you tomorrow and we'll do another couple hours, okay?
I'll send this off to you and
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Take care, man.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.